Hello, my name is Jack Buckley. I'm the program director at UCLA Medical Center, and I'm also the director of our anesthesia head neck team. And today I'm going to be interviewing Dr. Sam Shetman, who is currently a clinical associate professor in the Department of Anesthesiology at the University of Michigan Medical School. Dr. Shetman serves as the director of the head neck anesthesiology and airway management team at Michigan Medicine. He was the first fellow at the University of Michigan to do the Department of Anesthesiology's head neck and Advanced Airway Management Fellowship in 2016. He is currently serving as the president for the Society of Head Neck Anesthesia. He is recognized for his clinical expertise in airway management and the perioperative care of patients having head neck surgery. Dr. Shetman is an active member of the Society of Airway Management and also for the Difficult Airway Society in the United Kingdom.
Well, thank you, Dr. Buckley. I very much appreciate the opportunity, and I'm always excited to talk on head and neck anesthesia and airway management. So, looking forward to a bit of discussion around an important topic in head and neck anesthesia.
And today we're going to be discussing topicalization strategies for awake tracheal intubation. So, Dr. Shetman, if we could start with, could you please describe some of the common topicalization strategies which are used for awake tracheal intubations?
Thanks again, Dr. Buckley. I think before even getting into discussing the approaches to topicalization for awake tracheal intubation, I thought I'd highlight just the importance of the approach utilizing awake tracheal intubation. Oftentimes, in patients with a known history of difficult airway management or having predictors for difficult airway management or head and neck pathology that may render laryngoscopy, face mask ventilation, or supraglottic airway placement to be difficult, or even if the patient is a physiological difficult airway and at risk for rapid desaturation or at risk for aspiration events, consideration and utilization of awake tracheal intubation can really be vital to maintain oxygenation until the airway is secured. Another important point to recognize is that we often think about awake fiber optic intubation. Technically, that's now an old term, as most of us are using digital bronchoscopes. So we like to try to term this approach awake bronchoscopic intubation. There is also an approach utilizing awake video laryngoscopy that has been shown to take favor in certain patient populations, and also depending on the provider's skill set and their comfort level with different approaches. And as we think about utilizing one of these approaches, any intubation while a patient is awake is going to require topicalization of the upper airway. And before we even get into the approaches, I think thinking about sensory innervation and having an understanding of the nerves that need to be blocked in order to optimize success are very important. So the upper airway can be divided into the nasal and oral cavities, the pharynx, as well as the larynx. Sensory innervation of the upper airway is primarily supplied by the trigeminal, glossopharyngeal, and vagus nerves. And in thinking about this, we oftentimes also have to think about, are we approaching the patient with a orotracheal intubation or a nasotracheal intubation? And in thinking about a nasal approach, the nose is entirely innervated by branches of the trigeminal nerve. The septum and the anterior parts of the nasal cavity are affected by the anterior ethmoidal nerve. And then the rest of the nasal cavity is innervated by the greater and lesser palatine nerves. It's then important to think about the pharynx itself, and the pharynx is largely innervated by the glossopharyngeal nerve. The whole pharynx, the posterior third of the tongue, the tonsillar fauces, as well as the tonsils and epiglottis, are also covered by the glossopharyngeal nerve. And then the oropharynx is innervated by branches of the vagus, trigeminal, and glossopharyngeal nerve, with the posterior third of the tongue, vilecula, and anterior surface of the epiglottis being innervated by the tonsillar nerve, which is a branch of the glossopharyngeal nerve. The posterior and lateral wall of the pharynx are innervated by the pharyngeal nerve, which is a branch of the vagus. And the tonsillar nerve innervates the tonsils, and then the anterior two-thirds of the tongue are innervated by the lingual nerve, which is a branch of the mandibular division of the trigeminal. And then finally, in thinking about the larynx, this is innervated by the vagus nerve, and it above the vocal folds, which includes the base of tongue, posterior epiglottis, aryepiglottic folds, and arytenoids. It is the internal branch of the superior laryngeal nerve, which is a branch of the vagus nerve that supplies innervation. And then below the vocal cords, the recurrent laryngeal nerve, which is also a branch of the vagus nerve, supplies the mucosa below the cord. So in thinking about topicalization for awake tracheal intubation, we need to recognize that we oftentimes have to cover several the cranial nerves to be able to enhance our chances for success. So different strategies are utilized, oftentimes as maybe provider dependent, as well as related to patient's pathology and anatomy. But some of the common strategies include use of nebulized lidocaine, as well as approaching topicalization with a spray-as-you-go technique. There is also use of atomizers. Another approach utilizes the McKenzie technique. And then also more recently, high-flow nasal oxygen has been utilized in awake tracheal intubation and can be used to help with topicalization. And then finally, regional anesthetic approaches can be used to block these nerves and their branches. And oftentimes this can possibly be done with or without the use of ultrasound.
And Dr. Shetman, that's a kind of a nice description of the various options. But in your practice, what is your generally preferred topicalization technique and why?
So we tend to actually start with topicalization out in the preoperative holding room, where we give patients glycopyrrolate, which is an anti-siligogue to help dry out the mucosa. This is sort of an ongoing point of discussion within the airway world at the moment. Some feel that patients often can be scoped and don't have significant secretions or mucus without the use of glycopyrrolate. But glycopyrrolate, we find, does help to dry out the mucosa, which then helps with the uptake of local anesthetic. So we tend to give small doses of glycopyrrolate, usually 0.02 milligrams at a time out in pre-op. And we try to do this 30 to 45 minutes before actually going to the operating room to start the awake tracheal intubation to optimize drying of mucosa. Once we are in the operating room, in our practice, we actually put on high flow nasal oxygen at 40 liters a minute, and then begin the use of a nebulized lidocaine solution. If the patient is having a orotracheal awake intubation, with the nebulizer, we usually have the patient nebulize 4% lidocaine for about 5 minutes. And then once we've completed the nebulizer, then we begin with having the patient gargle and sort of swish and spit 4% lidocaine, usually about 3 milliliters. And we do that twice. The first time we often have the patients spit it out. On the second time, we often have them swallow to ensure that the epiglottis and larynx are covered. And then finally, we use an atomizer to actually spray about 2 to 3 cc's to make sure that the gag reflex has been abolished before we start our endoscopic approach to awake intubation. We tend to utilize awake bronchoscopic or awake endoscopic intubations the most. Very rarely do we use awake video laryngoscopy in our practice, often because we see a lot of head and neck cancer, limited mouth movement or mouth opening, or limited neck extension. We also like the use of high flow. In addition to helping spread lidocaine significantly, it also helps with oxygenation during awake tracheal intubation. And there is a bit of CPAP that's provided, somewhere between 5 and 8 centimeters of water, that may help stent the airway open and aid with passage of the bronchoscope.
And when you have a patient that has inadequate topicalization based on everything you've already described, what steps do you then take to try to improve the situation?
So that's a great question. And I think difficult topicalization is often a significant challenge. One piece that I always like to really highlight to other providers and trainees is that the answer to inadequate topicalization is not more sedation. You're trying to preserve oxygenation and spontaneous ventilation in these patients who you have concern with managing their airway post-induction of anesthesia. So more sedation oftentimes can result in loss of an airway. We do like high flow because it may give us a little more leeway and protection, but again, that does not mean to provide more sedation. So one strategy that we sometimes try is to actually dry the mucosa a bit more. So sometimes a little more glycopyrrolate might help. Oftentimes in patients with prior head and neck radiation or with infection or current large tumor burden, actually trying to topicalize can be very difficult. The use of high flow, as we've talked about, can be beneficial. Sometimes even turning the high flow up, if you're at 30 or 40 liters a minute, maybe to 40 or 50 liters a minute may help spread topical. Another challenge we often find in awake endoscopic or awake bronchoscopic intubation is that it's sort of the base of tongue that patients have challenges with topicalization. So sometimes trying to have doing an extra gargle with 4% lidocaine. Another strategy is actually using a video laryngoscope blade to pull the tongue forward and sort of have help to actually move the tongue out of the way. And if you're still continuing to struggle, actually taking a nasal approach may be beneficial because you can bypass some of the gag reflex and have a straighter shot through the pharynx into the larynx. So those are a few approaches that we sometimes take. And then finally, one other strategy that I think is important, and we'll talk a little bit more probably about regional approaches. But I think if patients are very hard to topicalize, oftentimes it's sort of at the level of the supraglottis and base of tongue. Sometimes a transtracheal block can be helpful as well, just because in performing this, you topicalize below the vocal fold, but patients tend to cough, and a lot of the lidocaine actually spreads then to the supraglottic structures as well. It is important, though, that no matter how much local anesthetic you use, we primarily use lidocaine. I think most US providers often use lidocaine in practice and even overseas as well. 9 milligrams per kilo of lean body weight is the maximal recommended dose. So that's always important to be cognizant of that as well.
And when you're doing these techniques, as you've described, what are some of the common pitfalls you've seen people have occur, and how do you deal with these?
So again, I think a few of the challenges that often arise are one, inadequate topicalization. I think, again, sort of as we've talked previously about a few different strategies for trying to optimize the use of local anesthetic and being careful around use of sedatives. There are different sedative approaches. We tend to utilize midazolam in small boluses, so usually a half milligram or a milligram at a time, and then a low-dose remifentanil infusion. But it is important to remember that the more agents you use, the higher risk for synergy from different agents that may lead to apnea and loss of the airway. Another challenge, sometimes patients are non-compliant, and I think this often presents a really significant challenge because to optimize topicalization, really, you have to have the patients being involved. I have found that the use of high flow can be very beneficial because you can essentially have the high flow again at 40 to 50 liters a minute. And sort of use an atomizer and to just spray lidocaine and then hope that the high High flow spreads the lidocaine significantly, and that does seem to be fairly helpful. Also, oftentimes, even with good topicalization, sometimes the patients feel sort of pressure right as the endotracheal tube goes into place. And I think that's oftentimes just talking the patient through that situation and having the OR team involved as well can be beneficial. Sometimes just having another person in the room holding the patient's hand as they go off to sleep can also be a very nice experience that can sort of help the patient in that scenario.
And earlier you mentioned some other topicalization techniques. Can you provide me a little bit more details about these and when you might consider using them?
So we talked significantly about sort of our approach with high flow nasal oxygen. I think I may break this down a little bit into topicalization approaches for both. We'll sort of go awake nasal intubation and awake orotracheal intubation. So with awake nasal approaches, the use of high flow again can be beneficial to help spread local anesthetic. So we tend to actually use the atomizer and spray 4% lidocaine into the nares, and then use Afrin or some type of vasoconstricting agent to actually vasoconstrict blood vessels to reduce risk for bleeding. Obviously, in a difficult airway, the last thing you want is to put a scope in and cause bleeding and then sort of not be able to see where you're going and/or lose the airway. So that's sort of one approach for nasal. Other approaches that exist as well include the use of nebulizers. So you can put lidocaine, aqueous 4% lidocaine, into a nebulizer. There's nebulizers that require the patient actually breathe and hold on to it. You can also use nebulized masks, which essentially can just be put onto the patient. So if the patient's non-compliant, you can then have them nebulized through the mask. It also sort of helps with nasal topicalization. Finally, if patients are on BiPAP, respiratory therapy in our practice often can put lidocaine through the BiPAP circuit. And I think this is another sort of important point to remember. Other strategies that also exist include the spray-as-you-go technique. And the way this is performed is that you actually connect a lidocaine syringe to the bronchoscope, and then you spray straight down the bronchoscope as you advance to topicalize the airway, going through either the nasal cavity or the anterior oral cavity, and then into the pharynx, and then supraglottic structures, the glottis, and then into the trachea. And you can sort of spray the entire way as you go. One pitfall here is that you sort of don't get real widespread coverage, but you do sort of get where you're going if you keep the bronchoscope straight. And it also does take a little time for the topical to be taken up. We tend to use this a bit right as we get to the glottic level, just to spray into the trachea right before we advance the tube. And then the use of atomizers and the McKenzie technique sort of go hand in hand. So what the McKenzie technique is that you can connect a oxygen cannula or oxygen tubing to wall oxygen, turn it up to 15 liters a minute, use a three-way stopcock, and then open it up. And on the end of the stopcock, you connect just to any gauge angiocath, and you can essentially spray lidocaine with high flow behind it. In many ways, this is exactly sort of what the high flow technique that we use is built upon. We just are doing it at 40 liters a minute. With the McKenzie technique that's been described, you can do it at 15 liters a minute. Similarly, atomizers or mucosal atomization devices exist, which essentially sort of also utilize the McKenzie technique, but you just connect an atomizer to a syringe filled with local anesthetic and spray, and then it gives a high force that sort of sprays the topical broadly at the level that you're spraying at. And then finally, some of the regional techniques that exist. So essentially, as we've talked about sensory innervation, there's a few types of nerve. There's three nerve blocks that really can be performed for awake tracheal intubation. Now, one challenge, again, you need to be aware of how much local anesthetic you're using with, again, the 9 mgs per kilo of lean body weight being the maximal dose. You also need to recognize that these techniques can be challenging. Again, you need a compliant patient. And there's oftentimes tumors and or significant vasculature that, if there's an injection that goes into vascular space, can really cause significant challenge with local anesthetic toxicity and subsequent loss of the airway in these difficult airway patients. So the glossopharyngeal nerve block essentially involves utilizing, it's often recommended to inject at the palatopharyngeal arch, which is sort of the base of the tonsillar pillar. There is sort of the transoral approach to this, as well as the peristyloid approach, which involves an injection posterior to the styloid process where the glossopharyngeal nerve lies. But you have to recognize here that the internal carotid artery sits very close by. And it's recommended to spray essentially about 2 to 4 cc's of 2% lidocaine when doing these blocks, and you need to do them bilaterally for the glossopharyngeal nerve block. Alternatively, you could use lidocaine soaked pledgets and just seat it at the glossotonsillar sulcus and sort of at the glossotonsillar pillar, which can help to topicalize the region as well. The superior laryngeal nerve block, again, the superior laryngeal nerve provides sensation to the larynx above the vocal folds, and it lies inferior to the greater cornu of the hyoid bone, where it splits into internal and external branches. And to perform the block using an external approach, you place the patient supine with a small degree of neck extension to facilitate identification of the hyoid bone. And then you can perform essentially what is a field block by walking off the bone inferiorly and injecting 2 mL of 2% lidocaine to block both the internal and external branches of the superior laryngeal nerve. And then finally, the recurrent laryngeal nerve blocks sensation below the level of the vocal folds. And the way this can be performed is that oftentimes you can palpate both the thyroid cartilage and cricoid cartilage, and then feel for the cricothyroid membrane. And you can use a 4 cc or 5 cc syringe filled with maybe 3 to 5 cc's of lidocaine, and attached to a 22 gauge angiocath. Aspirate as you go through the cricothyroid membrane, and once you have air bubbles come back, thread the catheter, take the needle out, and then re-aspirate to make sure you're in the airway, and then spray the lidocaine through the cricothyroid membrane and into the tracheal lumen. These techniques, it's also important to remember if patients have head and neck cancer or infection, there is risk of going through lymph nodes or cancerous or infectious tissue and spreading that then into the airway. So theoretically, we often try to avoid these techniques unless it's really challenging to topicalize patients. Sometimes we will then utilize a transtracheal block.
Well, Dr. Shepman, this was really, I think, an informative discussion. And I think even myself, I've learned a couple techniques that I might change in my practice. So thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
And thank you again, Dr. Buckley.